20 years later, examining the Florida connections to the September 11th attacks. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Most of the 9/11 hijackers lived and trained in Florida before carrying out the terrorist attack two decades ago. Questions still remain, though, about how they were able to operate for so long undetected or at least undeterred. Also this hour, we will hear from local Muslims about community building in the shadow of the attacks and how the experience may be different between generations. And later on, local governments may have more money, a lot more money, to spend as they put together their new budgets in the weeks ahead. It's all ahead on the South Florida Roundup with your phone calls and tweets here on WLRN. Our program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week, and thanks for supporting public radio here in South Florida. Saturday may mark 20 years since the September 11th attacks, but do we yet know the whole story, including how many of the attackers lived and trained in Florida, how they lived here in South Florida before that terrible day? Well, the story of the lead-up to the terrorist attacks and the subsequent investigations into how it happened, what U.S. intelligence agencies knew and learned about any planning, and why some information still remains secret, it remains incomplete. Here, 20 years later, the end of the war in Afghanistan does not end efforts to unearth and examine details, including any connections between the terrorists here in Florida and Saudi Arabia, an important U.S. ally in the Mideast. So what questions still remain unanswered? Where could those answers be? And how does Florida fit in even 20 years later? 800-743-9576 is our phone number, 800-743-WLRN. Or you can share your thoughts on the anniversary of 9/11 coming up on Saturday on our social media feed, at WLRN on Twitter. Dan Christensen is back with us. Dan is with the Florida Bulldog. Dan, welcome back to WLRN and the Roundup. Nice to have you again.
Hello, Tom. It's good to talk.
Yeah, wonderful to hear from you. You really, over pretty much anyone else, have led the push for greater transparency regarding the American investigation into the 9/11 attacks. You've been on this for years and years. You have sued the federal government over documents multiple times. What's the central question for you that remains unanswered two decades after the attacks?
Well, the central question is whether or not Saudi government was involved in financing and providing the legal term of material support to the 9/11 hijackers. There are many indications that they did provide such support, and that is the thrust of a lawsuit, a very enormous lawsuit that's playing out up in New York City between the families, what are called the 9/11 families, mm-hmm. meaning survivors and the relatives of the dead, and Saudi Arabia. And it is a remarkable lawsuit, and we're hoping that the rest of the answers are going to play out there.
For many years, official investigations by the United States government, Dan, as you know, have not concluded that there was any evidence of material support of the hijackers here in Florida and elsewhere prior to the 9/11 attacks by the Saudi Arabian government. And on Wednesday of this week, in fact, Saudi Arabian government released a statement. Some have referred this as a preemptive statement ahead of the 20th anniversary, saying earlier material made public has confirmed that the Saudi Arabian government was not involved in the attacks. Why do these questions linger?
Well, that's a bit of an overstatement. The 9/11 Commission did not conclude that they were not involved. Congress's joint inquiry did not conclude that they were not involved. There was at the time what they considered to be a lack of evidence. Part of the lack of evidence was the fact that our government, specifically the FBI, had withheld information from both of those two bodies. And a lot of that information had to do about what happened in Florida, most notably in Sarasota.
Yeah. I want to concentrate on Sarasota here in a moment. We're speaking with Dan Christensen with the Florida Bulldog, speaking about questions that still remain about the 9/11 attackers, how they operated in Florida, what was known about their operations prior to that attack, with the anniversary of the September 11th attacks coming up on Saturday here on WLRN, broadcast coming up at noon on Saturday, Blind Spot, The Road to 9/11. It's the story of the shadow struggle that preceded the attacks. That's at noon on Saturday here on WLRN. Let's welcome Amy Driscoll into the conversation. Amy is with our news partner, the Miami Herald. Amy's been a reporter, an editor, and an opinion page associate editor. Amy, welcome back to WLRN. Nice to have you again.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Why do you think these questions are still important 20 years after this terrorist attack?
Well, you know, I think that it's important to the 9/11 families, of course, the people who are, you know, still having questions these many years later. It's also very important to the nation as a whole, because any lingering questions about how this happened and why it happened only feed into this era of misinformation. I think that it's very important, it's critically important, that we get full disclosure of all of these documents and explore all these links thoroughly. You know, full credit to Dan Christensen and his organization for pushing on that these many years. But I think it's important for the nation and for the families, and also for the Saudi government, because they insist that they had no role in this. And, you know, I think it's important for us to clarify that going forward.
Now, President Joe Biden announced just a few days ago ordering the FBI and other agencies to review and declassify certain documents. Amy, how important is this step toward transparency or potential transparency?
I think it's a huge step in terms of trust, you know, trust in our government. We need to know what was done in our name. And it's been almost 20 years, but think about the Kennedy assassination. Some of those documents still are not fully open. That happened in 1963.
Right.
And look at all the conspiracy theories that came out of that. We need to know what happened on American soil, and we need to know it, you know, every step of the way. There should be nothing that's held back at this point. It's been 20 years. I don't think people are as tolerant today of waiting that kind of timeline if they were in the Kennedy assassination, because, you know, information has moved forward in a much quicker pace now.
Yeah, indeed. Dan, what stories could these documents, if they're declassified under this presidential order that President Biden issued just within a few days ago, what stories could these documents tell?
Well, I think they can tell us a lot. And what's really interesting about the president's order is that they can begin telling us and providing answers as of this weekend, as of tomorrow. Because the only document that's specifically referenced in the president's order is a 16-page conclusory analysis report by the FBI of a thing called Operation Encore, which was an FBI, almost a renegade operation within the FBI to look at Saudi complicity in 9/11. And it was a very internally controversial. We didn't even know it existed until actually Florida Bulldog, in our Freedom of Information Act litigation, got a copy of a report, summary report from 2012 about it. And I remember talking with former Senator Bob Graham about it, who headed up Congress's joint inquiry into 9/11. And he told me that this was quite startling to him, because everything that the FBI had been saying about Saudi complicity before that was that it had all been resolved by the 9/11 Commission back in 2004. But here we had a document that showed, as of October of 2012, the FBI and federal prosecutors in New York were looking to charge someone with providing what they call material support to the hijackers, specifically two of the hijackers that were out in Southern California and who were later aboard the American Airlines jet that crashed into the Pentagon.
There's two areas geographically of concentration of questions. One is regarding hijackers that were operating in Southern California, and the other was operating other hijackers that were operating prior to the attack on the Gulf Coast here in Florida, in Sarasota. You mentioned this and alluded to this earlier, Dan. This has been an area of both areas of investigation that you have focused in on. What is that Sarasota connection? And again, what questions still remain 20 years after this tragedy?
Unfortunately, lots of questions. But what happened back in Sarasota was there was an FBI investigation of a Saudi family who had abruptly moved out of their residence in an upscale neighborhood over there and moved back to Saudi Arabia about 2 weeks before the terrorist attacks
right.
of 9/11, correct. And it was sudden because they left behind their cars, they left clothes, they left food in the refrigerator and on the countertop, they left their furniture. They just booked out of there very fast. And the FBI in its documents used the words fled. And that got reported to the FBI and others by neighbors after the attacks, wanting to know what happened. So the FBI goes in, does an investigation, but they never told anybody. They never told Congress about this. They never told the 9/11 Commission about this. And it wasn't until my colleague, an Irish author, whose name is Anthony Summers, mm-hmm. originally found out about this, brought me into the investigation to look at this, that we reported this in Florida Bulldog. The Miami Herald picked it up the same day, mm-hmm. back on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and it became a pretty big deal. The mm-hmm. FBI later came out and said, acknowledged that they had indeed investigated, but said that they found nothing. The only problem with that was that after we sued them, trying to get an explanation as to why they concluded there was nothing to this, I began to receive documents from the FBI that stated, the single most important one, stated it was highly redacted for national security and other reasons, but it stated that these Saudis who had been living in Sarasota had, quote, many connections, unquote, to the hijacker, or not to the hijackers, but to the people involved in 9/11.
Yeah.
And that has not been satisfactorily explained. The FBI has later went on to try and discredit its own report, saying the agent who wrote it had did a poor job and had no basis for writing it. However,
which was an astounding claim by the FBI of one of its own.
Extremely astounding.
Amy Driscoll with the Miami Herald, on this coming 20th anniversary, the war in Afghanistan is over for the United States. How does that, or does that, change public interest and pressure toward these federal agencies and officials toward more full disclosure?
Well, I think that Afghanistan, that the changes in Afghanistan now have certainly pushed this back into people's immediate thoughts. And that combined with the anniversary, mm-hmm. I think that makes both of those things much more timely and of interest to the general public, even people who weren't born then. So I think it's important. And it's also just, you know, we knew then, I covered 9/11 in New York for the Herald, and we knew then this was a turning point in history.
Right.
Here we are 20 years later, and there are questions that are still unanswered. So these ghosts from the past, the Afghanistan war, this horrific attack in our own country, are wounds in the national psyche, and they need to be addressed. And the only way to address them is with sunshine. We need to see what everybody has said about it, and not have any secrets on it.
And with that sunshine could come what in particular? Certainly acknowledgement, perhaps, but also, right, the global tenor and the national security interests and concerns arguably still remain today as they potentially did, perhaps differently than they were exactly on September 12, 2001. But national security remains front and center for the federal
sure.
government.
And the Saudi government has been key player in our national security. Mm-hmm. So it is important that we know if there was any complicity back then.
And if I might chime in on that, Senator Graham has referred to Saudi Arabia as our perfidious ally. And that's obviously a startling statement. But if indeed they are our perfidious ally, we sure need to know that. And that needs to be a matter of historical fact.
What are the next steps, Dan, here as we await the potential disclosure of these documents as Department of Justice agencies look at the potential for declassifying some of these?
Well, the president's executive order has spelled it out. As of this weekend, we may get our first document. It'll be interesting to see whether or not that happens, because what the president has ordered is not the simple release of documents. He has ordered that the attorney general and other leaders conduct what are called declassification reviews of all these documents relating to Operation Encore and what happened in San Diego and Southern California in excess of 20 years ago now. And so they are looking at these with an eye to what can be declassified, instead of before always looking at it with an eye towards what needs to be kept secret. Mm-hmm. The president acknowledges there are certainly legitimate national security reasons to keep things secret. For instance, the names of informants, mm-hmm. Sources and methods, right. Things like that. But we do know from experience that a lot of information that they say is classified for national security reasons is classified for other reasons, such as embarrassment. And the president's order specifically says that that is not a reason to keep things secret. So we'll see how this is planned to play. It literally will play out over the, there's different deadlines, right. I believe 30, 60, and 180 days. But this first document, which is one of the key documents that the families are hoping to get, that will perhaps spell out more about what Operation Encore found, should be extremely important. And I know I'm waiting for tomorrow to see if they do release it.
You'll be hitting refresh, I imagine, on that browser pretty frequently, Dan. Amy, for the South Florida community, you mentioned you covered 9/11 for the Miami Herald, certainly, but for this community here in South Florida, 20 years may seem like a short moment for those of us who remember that day. It can seem like a long time ago. And South Florida played home to a number of these attackers. It was a place where these terrorists came and lived and trained and ate and drank and traveled and bought goods and services and interacted with the community. Questions still remain about how they were able to operate for so long, either undetected or undeterred. The new information that could come to light, how could that shape the thinking about how they were able to blend in, or how they were able to be a part of this community prior to launching this awful attack?
Well, you are right. They were. We have a special stake here in South Florida in figuring this out. They were here among us, as you say, eating and drinking and staying in motels and flight school training, which was one of those stunning revelations that came after the fact.
Yeah.
I think there was a realization afterwards how many clues they left behind that were not picked up. And I'm sure that has changed the way that we detect terrorists today. But again, we have to know everything there is to know so that we can all be prepared. I think, and we also need to understand what our government is doing in our name. And I think that requires full disclosure. Whatever these documents might say, they are critically important to all of us and keeping this nation safe. So, unless it endangers some other operation right now, they should be releasing them. I think that Biden's move on that part is an important one for all of us going forward.
Amy Driscoll is a reporter, editor, associate editorial page editor with our news partner, the Miami Herald. Amy, thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Thanks so much.
Dan Christensen with the Florida Bulldog has been really the singular push here for greater transparency regarding the American investigation into the 9/11 attacks 20 years on. Dan, thank you for sharing your reporting and resources with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
Much appreciated. Still to come, we're going to continue talking about the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, particularly here in South Florida. Voices from South Florida's Muslim community 20 years after that day. Coming up next here on the South Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. The legacy of the 9/11 attacks remains very present today. For some, it may be experiencing airport security. For Muslims, the attacks led to an increase in hostility, suspicion, discrimination. How has South Florida's Muslim community responded? How do those too young to remember that day 20 years ago think of its consequences today and into the future? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Abdul Hamid Samra is with us, Imam at the Islamic Center of Greater Miami. Imam, I'm going to ask you to unmute yourself, please, so we can speak and hear from you. Imam, nice to have you. Thank you for joining us here on WLRN. We're going to try to get you unmuted as we have a conversation here about the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks here in South Florida and the response from community voices here from the Muslim community here in South Florida. We will catch up with the Imam in a moment. We're going to be also speaking with Sophia Muhammad and Sufyan Bhatti. Both are University of Miami students. To each of you, welcome to the program. Thanks for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Sophia, let me start with you. How do you think about your Muslim community today?
Honestly, I think that we've built a very resilient community, especially in the aftermath of 9/11. Looking at our community today, I primarily have been attending the University of Miami over the past 4 years. So it's been different, like working to develop that sense of community outside of my like home community, which is in Pembroke Pines. Mm-hmm. So we've basically been working on a lot of initiatives to help build like the Muslim community's presence on campus. So for example, when I came to campus, I learned that halal food was not offered at the UM dining hall. And having consumed halal food throughout my entire life at home, which is what's been the same for many students who've also like been brought up at home and then come to college, it was really important for us to develop that. So that's just one of the things that we worked on. So this past year, now they offer it every day. And students have really had to adapt to like alternatives, you know?
Right. Yeah. Sufyan, how about from your experiences?
So I primarily grew up in a very big Muslim community back in Michigan. And so we had a lot of like Muslims all around, and it was a very like big community, and I felt very like welcomed and everything. About a year ago is when I came to UM, and it was a brand new place for me. First time being away from home during COVID times as well. And my first few weeks were a little rough here because it was hard to find that community because of COVID. Yeah. But working with Sophia and Dr. Samra, I was able to find people on campus. We were able to have Friday services every Friday that we offered, and students and faculty members were able to participate. And it was nice to get to know them and meet them from places all over the world. We also, towards the end of the year, we had Ramadan during COVID on campus as well. And we had nightly prayers where we invited all the Muslim students and faculty members and community members to come and participate and pray with us. So it was really nice to have that.
Yeah, that community building exercises, that ability to have those connections and build those relationships. Abdul Hamid Samra is with us now, the Imam at the Islamic Center of Greater Miami. Imam, nice to speak with you again. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. Describe how the South Florida Muslim community has changed, has evolved in the past 20 years?
Yeah, no question. September 11 was a dark, sad day, a tragedy brought so many pains and suffering to all people. But the Muslim community, the Muslim people paid the higher price because they were accused as a Muslim, all Muslim, that the responsibility or to be responsible for this act. Even though Islam is not, those who committed this act, they don't belong to Islam. We cannot even call them Muslims. Unfortunately, this is what happened. And the media, unfortunately, was kind of little negative on this. And because of that, as a community, we are subjected to like hate crimes, many mosques being attacked, many families being deported. And on and globally, many Muslims, innocent Muslim life destroyed and wasted, some countries destroyed. So that was big impact on our community. Yeah. Now the good things is that we felt that we have to connect. We have to be open to other people and tell them what is Islam and what is Muslim and what is the teaching of Islam. Islam is the religion of peace. It's the name of Islam, means the peace. And so that's why we try to be more involved in the community. Especially now, we support all candidates who run for office. Those especially who speak out against discrimination, mm-hmm. those who advocate for policy that respect rights and dignity of Muslims and oppose like profiling, surveillance. We were very involved in educating other people about Islam, and that we found that's the key, that the important thing is for people to know about Islam.
Yeah.
So we were so active in visiting universities, college, synagogue, churches, and so forth.
Imam, you've been in the United States since the 1980s. You've been here in South Florida since the early 1990s. You have seen the Muslim community change quite a bit in your time here just in this region. And I'm also wondering how the larger community relationship toward the Islamic faith has changed during your time here in South Florida.
Yeah, no question that the Muslim community is growing people get, I think, more knowledge how to work with the system and make sure that they present themselves in the good way, and when they demonstrate in a right way, and also they they have done so many things in connecting with other people, and they found this is the best way to present the good picture of Islam is to do good to the people, to the community. So we are so active in doing so, good things and helping our community. Like now we work with the schools around us, we adopt schools, mm-hmm. and we do distribution of food on weekly basis. We were very involved in the vaccination, where we provide vaccine and also testing for the COVID. And we were involved so many good projects, downtown project for the homeless. So that what we want to expose ourselves as Muslims when we are providing good things to our community.
Mom, let me bring in a voice that you will recognize since it's your daughter. Dima Samra is with us now, the Imam's daughter, and Dima runs a Muslim free clinic in Miami Gardens. Dima, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm sure you've heard your father say many of those things oftentimes around your own dinner table. How have you experienced this evolution of the South Florida Muslim community as a child during the 9/11 attacks 20 years ago and today?
Well, it was definitely, you know, a huge shock for us when it happened. And I remember, you know, the exact moment I was in my second period class in eighth grade. And it was a huge shock. And I was one of the only Muslim students who wore hijab then. And, you know, I did have issues. And I've seen how, you know, the Muslim community, we were more maybe secluded then, and now we're more out in the open trying to serve, you know, everyone. Like the free clinic that I work for was established by Muslims, and this is the second free clinic in the area as well. And it serves just the impoverished and uninsured, the people who are in need. So we try to get, you know, the message out there that Muslims, you know, are good people, and the religion itself is good and promotes, you know, goodness, mm-hmm. not terrorism at all. And we have nothing to do with that. Those are not Muslims. And honestly, we shouldn't have to defend ourselves because we have nothing to do with it.
Yeah. I'm going to ask this question for the imam, but I'd like to hear from the younger voices first, Dima. How do you think about practicing your faith, and how is that perhaps similar or different than how your father, the imam, has thought about it when he was your age, for instance?
I think, you know, honestly, I share similar points of view with my father. He's always been a very peaceful, calm person. You know, he practices his religion. It's your own faith. So it's your own relationship with God. Mm-hmm. And that's the same way I feel. And at the same time, you know, he's always been, you know, the first to volunteer and the first to give and the first to help and the first to support. And that's exactly how I feel.
Sufyan Bhatti, a UM student, how do you feel about your faith and perhaps how you express and practice that compared to older generation?
I feel very open about my faith, and I feel that, like, I live in a community here at the University of Miami where I feel safe practicing my religion. Like I mentioned before, we have Friday sermons mm-hmm. every Friday, and actually last year we did that in the middle of campus on the foot green, which is outside, so I felt comfortable enough to, you know, lead the sermons outside in front of people where other people are walking around. I felt really safe doing that, and I feel like it being in a community here at UM is very safe, and that I can be like an out Muslim mm-hmm. where I can really express my faith.
Sophia?
Similar to Sufyan, I feel very proud of my faith, and I feel very comfortable practicing it, especially given that South Florida is such a diverse community. I believe that Islam is a way of life more than it is just a religion. And so different aspects of my faith come about throughout the day, whether it's like what I'm eating, how I interact with people, how I carry myself in terms of modesty. And I think that just internalizing the ideals of our faith help us be more conscientious, empathetic people. Mm. And like what Dr. Summer and Dima were saying, it really does motivate me to be the best version of myself. So Islam promotes being good to yourself, good to your community. And that's a large part of why I'm so involved in community initiatives like volunteering. It's a big reason why I want to be a physician in the future, because I want to dedicate my life in the service of others. And that's something that my faith has instilled in me.
Imam, I'd like you to reflect on what you just heard there from those three individuals that we're also speaking with, and perhaps maybe how that could be the same or perhaps similar than maybe what we would have heard a generation ago.
Yes, in fact, today is Friday and our main service, and I'm going to do it in a few minutes. And the message today for the community is yes, to be proud of your faith, to proud to be a Muslim, at the same increase and do more of good work to the community and be more of help to others. That what is going to please God first, and then please people around you and make you satisfied.
Mom, let me ask you about a public opinion poll that was published recently by the Associated Press. It was conducted ahead of the September 11th anniversary. It found that 53% of Americans, a majority of Americans, have unfavorable views toward Islam, compared with 42% who have favorable views of your faith. How do you react to hearing something like that?
I would say sometimes, you know, even though they talk about religion, but there is always a political motivation. I would say there is some politics in there. But also, I think this is should give us also more motivation and encouragement to go out and educate people and make sure that everybody knows what Islam is all about.
Imam, we'll let you get to those services. We appreciate you spending some time with us here on WLRN. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Imam Abdul Hamid Samra with the Islamic Center of Greater Miami. Sophia Mohammed also has been with us, University of Miami student. Sufyan Bhatti, a UM student. To Sophia and Sufyan, thank you for sharing your perspective from UM's campus. Appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And Dima Samra, the daughter of the imam who runs a Muslim free clinic in Miami Gardens. Dima, thank you for sharing your voice with us today, too.
Thank you for having me.
Much appreciated. Still to come on the South Florida Roundup, we're going to switch gears, talk about local governments. Local governments may have more money, a lot more money to spend as they begin putting their budgets together in the weeks ahead. We'll talk about the money and the spending plans coming up next on the Roundup. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks to billions of dollars of federal government COVID-19 stimulus money and the hot housing markets, local governments in South Florida have a lot more money to spend in the year ahead. Local governments are putting together their spending plans now, responding to the ongoing pandemic, housing crunch, tough traffic, climate change, and the social justice reckoning. This is Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava on WLRN's Sundial.
Our budget is a more honest budget, a more transparent budget, and is actually a budget that reflects the initiatives and the reforms that I promised when I ran for office and the reason I was elected.
So some local government budget hearings to hear from the public underway. What are the spending priorities for these local agencies? How do you want your local tax money spent in your name? Where's the money coming from? 800-743-9576, our phone number, 800-743-WLRN, or on Twitter at WLRN. Doug Hanks is the Miami-Dade County Miami-Dade County reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald. Doug, welcome back to the program. Nice to have you again.
Thanks for having me.
So how have the federal stimulus dollars changed this upcoming budget for the county?
Well, it's a great year to be a mayor submitting a budget proposal because there's lots of new money to spend. And this mayor got elected with the backing of unions, and the unions are having a good budget. She's proposed some raises mm-hmm. that really are funded by these federal dollars. She's proposed some big increases in her budget, $3 million for staff in her office, and for the social services arm of the county, which has been a big priority for her, and also a lot more spending on the environmental regulatory side of things, like water quality and things, and also post Surfside mm-hmm. put in more money for like inspectors and more money for the 40-year recertification that everyone's now very aware of. So a lot of extra dollars going through that budget.
Yeah, and those extra dollars that are coming out of the federal stimulus money, non-recurring revenue, that's the phrase, right, Doug? Non-recurring revenue. Those dollars may not be there in the years ahead.
Well, they certainly won't be there in the years ahead down the road. They do plan on having a significant chunk next year, meaning 22 to 23. These budgets start in October. More than $100 million in 2022, October 2022 to September 23.
Right. What about the rebound in tourism? A year ago, a year and a half ago, lots of worries about local government budgets, particularly here in Florida, that are dependent on, you know, hotel bed taxes, sales tax revenues from restaurants and whatnot. And as we've seen the tourism sector, hospitality sector rebound, to what extent have those visitors helped fill budget holes?
Well, I think that the hotel taxes are still a negative for the budget, and they're using a big chunk of the federal dollars to make. Now, they've also spent a lot of those hotel tax dollars on the Peace and Prosperity Plan.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, sidebar on that. But yeah, they are revising their numbers upwards, and there is going to be some extra money to spend.
You're fading in and out there, Doug, a little bit on the audio.
I'll tell you, this is my microphone.
Fair enough. So let me try something else here a little bit and talk to us about the impact of real estate, the rising tide of real estate prices, and how that has impacted these spending plans and the ability to have these dollars go to the programs that the mayor and the commissioners would like them to go to.
Well, I mean, the property tax roll grew roughly to forecast. So that was a not bad case scenario for them. But they would have been tight without this federal money for sure. I mean, they were feeling it last year, and that was only a partial pandemic. So, but I think there's concerns about how much growth they can count on from these property tax values in the years ahead. I mean, their forecasts show deficits.
Right.
So it's not super rosy down the road.
Let's talk about a little of the spending priorities that have been expressed by the mayor, Daniela Levine-Cava. Transit has been one of them. To what extent do we see public transit being prioritized in spending plans?
Well, it's not in the budget yet, but they're getting ready to propose a $20 million increase in the bus system for what they call the Better Bus mm-hmm. Network, which when it was launched under the previous mayor, Carlos Jimenez, is going to be budget neutral, and it was super controversial. So we got to make tough choices. No more tough choices. We're just going to increase the service.
Right.
So, and people love it. So, and that it looks like it will be a really nice upgrade. We'll see what the commissioners say, because, you know, they'll have the outlook into individual routes, and there will be some cuts, but they're spending $20 million extra a year, which is like a 7% increase. It's very significant.
Yeah, that's
to improve service. Yeah. So,
what about the chatter that you may be picking up on regarding proposed infrastructure spending from the federal government and the kind of lining up that local governments are wanting to do for that, and kind of where in the queue could South Florida be?
I mean, some of that money is almost already spent. It isn't, but you hear it in budget discussions. It's like, wow, it's too bad about this deficit. Oh, well, there's going to be an infrastructure bill. There is an infrastructure bill. So it's amazing how bipartisan the embrace is in the local level of federal spending. I mean, the COVID relief in 2020 was huge for the Jimenez administration.
Yeah.
And the stimulus bill of 2009 was funding county police payroll for several years. Mm-hmm. So these big federal spending bills are just huge, huge, huge for the local governments. And it's not just the county, you know, the cities are getting big checks from this COVID, from the rescue plan bill as well.
Yeah. On the county side, what about law enforcement? So much of that spending was under scrutiny a year ago with the social justice reckoning movement. Does that scrutiny still exist as the mayor and her administration put together these plans?
Well, I would say kind of no, in that, that really never gained traction. Hmm. The police budget got its increase, as it always does, and it will again this year. And there is some more spending on like what you would maybe call the crime prevention, the prosperity agenda, but it's very minor compared to what is being spent on police and the jail. And you know, so much of the scrutiny on spending on law enforcement last year was on this plan to build a replacement jail, which the mayor says she supports and likely will move forward under her first term. That's going to be the timing. So, you know, the only thing that is going to defund police spending in my mind is CRAs, right? I mean, that is something that actually takes money out of the general fund and diverts it elsewhere. But it's unheard of, really, to see the police budget in Miami-Dade County reduced.
Yeah. Doug Hanks, county reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald. Doug, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks for having me.
Nancy Klingener covers the Keys for us here at WLRN, joining us from Key West. Nan, lots of talk, of course, across South Florida with these local governments looking at the budgets with the fiscal year beginning next month. Keys record tourism, right? I mean, it has been crowded in the Keys over the past many months. How are those tourism dollars impacting county spending plans?
Yeah, they're back to or above the 2019 levels, and that was a record year for tourism in the Keys. So they are seeing, you know, unseen before numbers in their sales taxes and other indicators like that. And the property values are also climbing here. So
right, and then the third leg of that stool, the American Rescue Plan, the federal stimulus dollars.
Right. They expect to get about $14.5 million from that, although they have not decided yet how they will spend it. So it's not really part of this budget. They say they have longer to decide how to spend it until 2026, and they're waiting to see the final rules from Treasury about how they can spend it.
Affordability is housing affordability can be an issue. Certainly is an issue in Monroe County. It's an issue all over South Florida. Transportation, an issue, the risk to climate change. Tell us a little bit about how the Monroe County Commission approaching the priorities.
Yeah, I would say that climate adaptation is probably on top of the county's budget list for of those that you just mentioned. They're looking at putting $1 million a year into a couple of pilot road raising projects. Mm. And other canal restoration projects and just all kinds of climate adaptation.
And this, are they targeting any particular source for those dollars to spend on climate adaptation, or is it general fund?
They are targeting every possible source for those from the federal, state government, everything they can. Yeah.
Let's talk about the housing situation, a real lack of affordable housing, certainly in the Keys, and the county reaching full build out. New construction can be hard to come by. To what extent is housing being prioritized in this upcoming budget?
I don't think it's prioritized to any level it hasn't already been. Hmm. But the county did this year recently commit to spending $600,000 a year for 3 years to support an assisted living facility in Key West for seniors. It's a new facility, and it's been in real trouble. So the county, along with the city of Key West and the local housing authority, are stepping up, and that will at least allow people who are getting older to be able to stay in the community.
I think today is the fourth anniversary of Hurricane Irma. Is that right, Nan?
I think it is.
Yeah, I know I had to mention that. But I bring it up in that in the aftermath of that storm, the lack of housing became a real economic issue in terms of the labor force for Monroe County. And the demand of an increase in tourism was putting on the availability of workers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was really surprised when the initial census numbers came out for the Keys to see that our population has grown since 2010. Because, as you know, we saw a number of people leave after Irma. And so it's really interesting to me. And I'll be digging into who these new residents are. Mm-hmm. Are they snowbirds? You know, are they? I mean, if they're residents, they're at least here a good part of the year.
Yeah.
What that means for the county just economically and demographically.
All the counties, of course, are dealing with the pandemic. All families and households, businesses are all dealing with it. The Monroe County Commission particularly directly impacted recently with the county commissioner, Mike Forrester, dying from COVID complications earlier this week. The Monroe County mayor has been quarantined after being exposed to someone who tested positive. How does the virus impact the budget negotiations, the planning, the priorities that need to be happening in the weeks ahead?
Yeah, I mean, the budget is already pretty much in final form. Its final approval is scheduled for next week, next Wednesday. So all that was decided before this really hit Monroe mm-hmm. as hard as it has. But I'd say we're just going to be looking to see if this has an impact in terms of people coming to the Keys. You know, we're starting to see big events get canceled again, like Fantasy Fest's big parade and street fair. So I think that is how it will be going forward. And if it turns out that they aren't bringing in the kinds of numbers that they expected to, then they'll obviously have to adjust.
Yeah. Nancy Klingener covers the Keys for us here at WLRN from our southernmost bureau at the studios of Key West. Nan, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks, Tom.
It is local government budget season, and we've got a short guide if you want to hear, you want to have your voice be heard. It is on our website, WLRN.org. Look for the story, Budget Season is Here in South Florida. Here's what you need to know to chime in, to have your voice be heard. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week here on WLRN. It is produced by Andrea Perdomo. Chris Remington helped with our production. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations and our program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting public radio. This program on WLRN is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist.
WLRN Public Media.